My voice is running out of gas, as you can hear, but we're just going to make it to the end. Firstly, if you'd like to fill out one of those sheets, it may help us to recommend the doctrine sessions to somebody else. There was a very good, on the retreat, somebody just did a very good one. He said, "Ow, wow, now." "Ow, my knees." "Wow, I understand. Now I should be a good Catholic." That was his testimonial on the retreat. That one is going to get publicized. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. "Ow, wow, now." So if you can come up with the equivalent of "Ow, wow, now" for the doctrinal sessions, please have a go. Then, today I promised there's that story. I promised that for 11 o'clock. That'll be the little happiness to send you away with. But this morning, 9 o'clock today, after Shumani Generous, well, actually before and around, the key villains, as told to us by Sisi Nono, whom Pius XII was attacking in Shumani Generous, and who are responsible for the disaster of Vatican II, who bear very considerable responsibility for the disaster of Vatican II. This is a letter, some of you may have seen it, it's a letter from the seminary that came out in June of 1993. But though you may have seen it, it's perfectly possible you didn't get hold of it. It's quite tough. So we'll have a look at it with a view to seeing the main ideas of Blondel, French philosopher, de Lubac, French theologian, von Balthasar, Swiss theologian. Blondel died in 1949. De Lubac died, I think, in 1991, and Balthasar in 1988. Balthasar had just been made a cardinal by John Paul II, but died just before he could go down to Rome to collect his cardinal's hat. De Lubac was made a cardinal by John Paul II in, I think, the 1980s. And another one like that, that he made cardinal, who was the third one? Congar, yes, that's right. Congar, he also made cardinal, I think that's right.
Like a year ago.
Yeah, quite recently. Then Congar died quite recently. No, he hasn't made Chilibet's cardinal. No, I don't think so. But he did, the three of the key thinkers of Vatican II, Congar, von Balthasar, de Lubac, John Paul II made cardinals. John Paul II totally believes in Vatican II. And yet we were saying yesterday, and I'm sure it's true, the Holy Ghost is stopping John Paul II from the ultimate destruction of the church. He's doing terrible damage, but he's not going to destroy the church. The Holy Ghost will stop him from doing that, which is why the villains want him out of the way. The villains, of course, don't think of Vatican II. The villains don't think of the Holy Ghost. They don't have him in mind. So, this is on three sheets, six sides. The first side begins to introduce Blondel, 1861 to 1949. But it's Blondel is a philosopher. The first side says, you know, why philosophy is important. Every man has some philosophy. Even if it's only the philosophy that he doesn't have a philosophy. Even if it's only the philosophy that he despises philosophy. Still he has a philosophy. Every man has some way of handling reality with his mind. And that way of handling reality is, whether he calls it that or not, his philosophy. So philosophy, every man has a philosophy whether he likes it or not. The Catholic Church's philosophy is realistic. In other words, respect for the object. The object tells me what it is. The object tells my mind what it is. My mind doesn't tell the object what it is, but the object tells my mind what it is. That's sheer common sense. You didn't come all the way to Minnesota to hear such things like that. But I mean, that's common sense which has today to be said. People today are losing their common sense in the most incredible fashion. However, the bottom paragraph there. If all men wanted to submit to reality, philosophy would have, instead of the contempt it earns today, an excellent reputation, And all men would be conscious or unconscious Thomists. That's the church philosophy, which is submission to reality. On the contrary, the modern world, being marinated in liberalism and steeped in revolt, refuses Thomism just as it refuses reality. The modern world does not like Thomas Aquinas. He's too submissive to reality. We want freedom. Accordingly, Catholic thinkers, too much in love with the modern world, want only a way out of the Church's classical Thomistic theology and philosophy. They want a philosophical justification of fantasy. They don't want to be submitted to the reality. They want to be liberated from reality. This philosophical justification of fantasy is what Blondel gave to Father Lubach, who is father of the new theology, we told you yesterday, La Nouvelle Théologie. And La Nouvelle Théologie is the charter of Vatican II. Side 2. All of this letter is simply taken from C.C. Nona. There's no thinking of mine in it. But they're very, very good articles in C.C. Nona. The first feature of Blondel's writing, noted by C.C. Nona, is its apparent vagueness and imprecision. His enemies could not pin him down. His friends would not pin him down. Because in this way, while deserving condemnation, he managed to slip out of forever being condemned by the Church. Because he was vague. However, the grand lines of his thought were clear to friend and foe alike. So you can see that the technique of the modernists, the church, the good church is in control, the good guys are in control, and they will hammer anybody who's clearly a bad guy, so the bad guys have to disguise themselves. So the bad guys are constantly playing with ambiguous language and then saying something and saying the exact opposite and saying they didn't mean it and saying that what they really meant was. They're just playing around. But the enemies know what they're really up to, and their friends know what they're really up to. But they're too slippery to get properly condemned by the official church. The grand lines in 4 points of Blondel. Blondel starts from the desire to win over modern man. It's always the same. The Catholics must get through to this Protestant world. The Catholics must get through to Protestants. True. The Catholics must reach Protestants. True. That's true ecumenism. But Protestants reject all Catholic ideas. True. Then the Catholics need to change Catholic ideas in order to get them through to Protestants. False. You can't change Jesus' truth in order to make it acceptable to villains. If somebody's drowning in a river, it's no way to save him to jump in and drown with him. Common sense. Blondel starts from desire to win over modern man who is unimpressed by objective philosophy. That's the philosophy that respects reality. In other words, by a philosophy of submission to the real object. So, Blondel, on the excuse of reaching out to modern man who is all subjectivist, me, 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 not the thing, the thing, the thing, Blondel will jump into subjectivism. Modern man is drowning, and so he must jump in and drown with him. That's the principle of Vatican II. It's true that Vatican II is right next to modern man, but it's right away from the saving word of God. What's the use of being right next to the drowning man if you drown with him? So the point one of Blondel, get over, reach out to modern man. Two, a man's mind being objective or made for the object outside a man, while a man's heart is the heart of the subject or the man inside, Blondel's next step is to argue that the Catholic faith goes rather from heart to head than from head to heart. See, Blondel is wanting to reach out to modern man. Here's modern man. A modern man refuses the reality of the object. That's objectivity. And this is modern man. So modern man refuses the knowledge, the objective knowledge of the thing. Then what's left? Modern man says, I don't want that tree to tell me it's a tree. I want to feel that it's an elephant. Because I like elephants. So, coming up from inside modern man, from his big bleeding heart, coming out from his big bleeding heart is what he feels the treat is. So he's going to, by his feelings, he's going to tell the object what it is. This is subject, subjectivity. So this is modern man. Blondel says we've got to reach out to modern man. So we've got to adapt the faith to this thing. So what the faith is going to be is a nice feeling of the heart. Since a man's mind is objective, or made for the object outside reaches modern man, while a man's heart is inside, the next step of Blondel is to argue, in order to get in sync with modern man, that the faith comes from heart to head, rather than from head to heart. So where St. Paul says that the faith comes from outside, faith is by hearing, which is catechumen sense, Blondel says the faith comes from experience inside. The faith is what I experience, it's inside me. It's a cozy glow. Now if you tell people that something is a cozy glow and a nice feeling, people today buy it. They like cozy glows and nice feelings. Warm fuzzy, yes, I feel tingly all over. People like that. So if you say to them, the Catholic faith is a tingly feeling all over, they'll buy it. Well, that's Vatican II. That's Blondel. So the third step. So one, we've got to get through to modern man. Two, modern man is subjective, so we've got to make the faith subjective. The faith comes from inside. Three, the supernatural sanctifying grace, which of course this comes from outside, sanctifying grace, everything supernatural comes from God. The supernatural becomes then a need. It's no longer something coming from God outside. It's something coming from inside. So the supernatural is all inside me. So the supernatural is simply the cozy glow, a special cozy glow coming up from inside. And then I project it outside with my nice fuzzy feelings. In other words, God is the creation of my nice fuzzy feelings. Horrible blasphemy, but that's how the moderns are. So, third step. The supernatural is a need or demand of the human heart. So the supernatural comes from inside the needs of my own heart. The supernatural is subjective. It's inside me. Because nothing can enter a man which does not come from out of him and correspond in some way to a need he has of expansion. Thus, as Blondel's subjectivism undermined all objectivity of the faith, the subject has completely replaced the object, so his naturalism subverts everything supernatural. The supernatural is inside my own heart. My own heart belongs to my nature. Therefore, the supernatural belongs inside my nature. The supernatural is natural. There's nothing above nature about the supernatural. The supernatural is simply the name given to another cozy feeling inside my own heart. An extra cozy feeling of my own heart. A need for an extra cozy feeling, and then that extra cozy feeling inside my heart. Sorry? And the whole, his naturalism subverts, let's say, undermines everything supernatural. And the whole order of grace, which is way above nature, is pulled down inside nature. What remains of Catholicism? What remains of the Catholic faith? However, Blondel's version of the supernatural held de Lubac spellbound. De Lubac, in turn, bewitched the fathers of Vatican II, so that in the main documents of Vatican II, Nostra Aetate in Agentes, the word supernatural is completely avoided. You may think, says the artist, that philosophers and theologians are people up in the clouds who have no influence. They have an enormous influence. Few people read them, perhaps, but they have an enormous influence. Fourth point. Blondel changes the very definition of truth. Of course he does. On this system, in objectivity, truth consists in matching my mind to the real thing. I've got truth in my mind when my mind believes, holds that 2 and 2 is 4, like it is out there. I have truth in my mind when I hold that that wall is yellow. It is. I have truth in my mind when my mind matches the object. Not for Blondel. Blondel says that that's a chimerical, an unreal definition of truth. Blondel, like Kant and the others, presumably believes that the mind can't attain reality. So Blondel defines truth as the real matching of mind and life. See? So as life can shift, so the mind shifts, and so truth shifts. And as life evolves, so the truth evolves. So we're into a changing truth. 2 and 2 are 4 today, 5 tomorrow, 6 the day after, and 4 the day after that again. This is a definition leaving room for the truth to be in continual movement, with nothing ever determined or fixed. Hence we've got a shifting truth, an evolving faith, and a living tradition, which is what Cardinal Ratzinger talks about, a living tradition which will enable the Lefebvrist's fixist tradition, that's you and me, to be condemned. You and I believe in a fixist tradition, which is dead, because it doesn't move, it doesn't change. Yeah? Whereas they, Rome, believes in a living tradition. Yeah? What can you do with these characters? They've bent their minds. There's nothing you can do with them. So those are 4 points. 1, we've got to get through to modern man. 2, therefore we've got to subjectivize the Catholic faith. 3, therefore everything supernatural will become purely natural. And 4, a change of the and truth evolves. We're going to shift the definition of truth. After all, my heart is constantly changing and moving. And the truth comes from my heart. It's my heart that knows the truth. An English poet at the beginning, way back in the 1800s, he was only a poor Protestant, so he couldn't know better. He said, "I believe in nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections." Stop and think about that one for a moment. John Keats. "I believe in nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections. I desire my neighbor's wife." That's the holiness of the heart's affections. Imagine what remains of the Ten Commandments when you believe in nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections. Not much.
Wow.
Yeah? And that's, of course, the denial of original sin. The poor fellow has no idea that his heart is riddled with original sin. And so those affections stand a good chance of being sinful affections. You better sit on top of them if they are. Oh, no. I believe in nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections. Warm, fuzzy feelings. Oh, my. Completely feminine. Was Blondel in good faith? Very interesting. And this was the section I was referring to. Are these characters in good faith? They put on such a good show of being in good faith. They are so convinced of the holiness of their heart's affections. It's such a crusade to put forward the holiness of their heart's affections, that they make a very good show of being in good faith and being well-intentioned and being, sincere. They are as sincere can be. And so they make a good impression. And you're inclined to believe that they're in good faith. Well, a prominent Dominican at the time thought that Blondel was not in good faith. And his reasons could be applied as a test to all modernists. 1. Blondel keeps on quoting texts of St. Thomas so as to make them mean the opposite of what they say. That's trickery. It's dishonest. He repeatedly meets well-argued criticisms from his adversaries with a mere categorical denial. He's got no counter-arguments. He can't argue because he's given up the head, so he's got no arguments. It's all just his fuzzy feelings. So he simply denies what the opposite arguments say. 3, he continually claims to be misunderstood. You don't understand me. Indeed I don't. I don't understand your thinking that you're right, but I do understand how you are wrong, say the good guys. But since anybody who disagrees with them doesn't understand them, because anybody who disagrees with them is not getting on the warm, fuzzy feeling wavelength. And the moment you get on the warm, fuzzy feeling wavelength, then of course you agree with him. So, you aren't on my wavelength, he says. Indeed I'm not, and I'd better not be. Well, if you're not on my wavelength, then you don't understand me. I will go to people who do understand me. They're weasels, do they?
Do they believe themselves?
Yes, I think they do. They're blinded, they're punished by God with blindness, and they do believe themselves. Yes, I think they do. With all their heart, yes, is exactly right. With all their heart, they believe themselves, exactly. They have allowed their warm, fuzzy feelings to take over their head. I said on the first page there, look at the fourth paragraph. As Aristotle said long ago, halfway down the fourth paragraph, even if we refuse philosophy, we still have to philosophize that refusal of philosophy. For instance, even if a man chooses to follow his feelings, his head still has to hand in and to go on handing in its resignation. That action of the head, governing or refusing to govern his life, is the explicit or implicit cautions or unconscious philosophy. Supposing you're on a ship. If you let go of the rudder, the ship will be driven by the sea and the wind, right? For the ship to be driven by the sea and the wind, you have to let go of the rudder and keep on letting go of the rudder. If you grabbed hold of the rudder and used it, you could steer the ship, right? The head is made to steer the feelings. If you let go of the head, the feelings will take over. But you have to keep on letting go of the head for the feelings to take over and keep on taking over. Because the head is always of a nature to steer the feelings and control them if you will use it. The head is natured to govern the feelings. But you have to take hold of your head and use it in order to make it govern the feelings.
But as this goes on, isn't there a tendency for the head to act accordingly and always just govern
the feelings? The less a man uses his head, the more he gives primacy to his feelings, yes.
We're coming through this stage of suffering where the head was trained.
Yes.
But you're starting to see it in another generation after us, that it's less and less.
Exactly. It's true. The head is less and less trained. Modern education less and less trains the head. And therefore the head, even if it wants to, is less and less capable of taking over or taking back control. It's an incredible situation. Television encourages, of course, the abandonment of the head. What I like about Stone is that the man is thinking. I do believe the man is thinking. Oliver Stone. Behind these flashing images, he talks the modern language, but behind is a head that's doing some thinking. So, he claims to be misunderstood, and he is always explaining how his thinking is really orthodox, so that to this day it is disputed what he's actually saying. So he's always saying, and then saying the opposite, and saying what he really meant to say, and saying how you don't understand it. These are four signs of a slippery and tricky of a deceiver. There are four signs of somebody who's deceived. If a man is absolutely honest about what he thinks, he can come out with it clean, come out with it clear and straight. If he doesn't come out with it clear and straight, he's got something to hide, and he's not being honest and upfront and sincere.
Probably not honest with himself.
No.
He's self-blinded.
Yeah.
And it's a punishment from God. The terrible thing about lying, it's the eighth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness. The terrible thing about lying is that it's its own punishment. When a man tells a lie for the first time, he half believes it, let's say. When he tells it for the second time, he three-quarters believes it. The third time, he seven-eighths believes it. By the fourth time, he's so into it that he believes it completely. And from then on, he's blind. And he's put his own eyes out. A man can put his own eyes out. It's a horrible thought, but I mean, if I take some sharp instrument and do that, I could put my eyes out. And men can commit the suicide of their reason. A lot of people today do that. They don't want to think. Because their conscience and their thinking accuses them of what they're doing. They don't want to be accused. And so they blind their reason. They commit the suicide of their reason. It's very common today. Very, very common all around us. People refusing to think, not wanting to think, and committing suicide of the faculty which does think. It's a terrible situation. It's a punishment from God. It's a just punishment from God. So, there's Blundell. One, get through to modern man. Two, subjectivize. Three, subjectivize the supernatural and make it natural. Four, subjectivize the truth. So it's me instead of reality. So it's me in place of God. I am going to create reality. The creator of reality is God. Then I become God. It's man in the place of God. Man who becomes the creator of reality, the governor of reality, who no longer submits to reality, but creates reality. It's diabolical pride, blindness, stupidity.
The whole world has gone this way.
Yes, the whole world has gone this way is exactly correct. Yes. And all of Vatican II was the Catholic Church finally following along the modern world. That's right.
But because of our inordinate weaknesses, it's no longer the heart, it's something down with the passions.
Yes, it's no longer the holiness of heart's affections, it's the holiness of something else. Yes. Interesting. Discerning readers dismissed any supposed later change in his thinking as being merely cosmetic, in other words, arranging appearances. Amongst friends, he would drop the disguise. That's the clincher. In 1932, when Father de Lubac accused him of paying too much heed to his Catholic critics, Blondel replied by return of post that back in the old days of, quote, unbending extrinsicism, meaning too rigid respect for the object, the extrinsic object, the external object, the object outside, too great respect for the external object. Just imagine. Because of that, Blondel said that he had had to go slowly and carefully in order not to incur condemnations by the church, which would have slowed everything down and which would have compromised the whole effort being undertaken, the cause being defended. In other words, Blondel knew exactly what he was doing. He was deliberately deceiving the church authorities as to what he really thought in order to be able to continue working from inside the church to reform it. See? These modernists are blinded. They think that Jesus' church belongs to them. That they have a better idea than Jesus of what to do with Jesus' church. And since Jesus' church is such an impressive structure, with so many convents, so many sisters, so many seminaries, so many buildings, then all of this structure must be taken over and used for the great cause of the New World Order. But it must got to be taken over from within, by deceiving the authorities. The poor authorities are too old-fashioned and too dumb to understand the need for this change. We understand it. Therefore, if they're going to condemn us while we're on the way to changing it, we'll have to deceive them for the time being. We'll have to work around them for as long until they get with it. But with Vatican II, of course, the authorities got with it. And the authorities themselves are handing over the whole structure of our Lord Jesus Christ's church, lock, stock and barrel, to the globalists and one worlders. That's what's happening now. But the process began, well, it began with Protestantism, really. It went on with liberalism. It built up with the tremendous liberals' pressure all around the church. For a while, the popes, with the kind of encyclical you've been reading, resisted. With Vatican II, the popes finally gave up and said, okay, guys, let's stop, let's give up resisting. We can't lick liberalism, so let's join it. And there was only two bishops that said no. Archbishop of Heaven, Bishop de Castromont, who stood up and effectively said no.
Didn't that have something like 450 at first? That's subjective.
Yes. At the end of the council, Archbishop of Heaven always said there were 450 bishops, good guys, who were determined to resist. But when they all went back into their own diocese, as I was saying the other day, and when they began to die, they were old, of course, most of them are old men, the bishops, older men, they began to die. The Pope Paul VI had all of the control. Pope Paul VI hammered them. The resistance fell to pieces. And Archbishop Lefebvre was left on his own. And when Archbishop Lefebvre in the 1970s began the Society of St. Pius X, during the 1970s, I can remember, he was always hoping that one or two or three bishops would come and join him. If only they could have made a small group, a little group of three or four or five, it would have carried much more weight than just him. But it wasn't to be. Those bishops, he went and visited the good ones, the best ones. He visited them and said, look, Your Excellency, we've got to do something. And none of them, Cardinal Siri, for instance, none of them would ever move. None of them would ever move. Except Bishop de Castromeyer. Even Bishop de Castromeyer waited until he had retired at the age of 75 before coming out in public alongside the Archbishop. But when he came out, he came out in spades.
But he kept the tradition with
He did keep the tradition in his own diocese. Read the excellent book on Bishop Kestermeyer and his diocese, The Mouth of the Lion by Dr. White, Dr. David White. It's a very good book. The Mouth of the Lion by Dr. White.
How's that bishop in the Philippines?
He's doing well. He's holding his ground. And apparently there's now a second. His example has drawn a second bishop in the Philippines to follow him.
Retired bishop.
I think another retired bishop. Yes, I think so, yes. Let's move on. He was deliberately deceiving the church authorities as to his real thinking in order to be able to continue working from inside the church to reform it. Some reform. Surely Blondel himself sincerely believed in his work of rediscovering the authentic Christianity. Answer, yes. And the whole modern world lines up to congratulate him on his planting of the minds to blow high sky the antiquated church. But did his conscience congratulate him or rebuke him? In any case, when Blondel consulted Father de Lubac whether his theses were not going a bit too far, de Lubac whipped round and assured him that his thinking was spontaneously Catholic enough to need no timid cover-up. In other words, when Blondel's conscience said to him, oh, maybe this is not quite Catholic, he appealed to his priest friend, and the priest friend, don't worry, you're fine, magnificent, wonderful. So, of course, the layman stayed in it. I know that shortly before Blondel's death, Garrigou Lagrange, the great French, the real French Dominican, good man, Father Garrigou Lagrange wrote Blondel a letter saying, you're going to soon be before your maker. You'd better think about everything you've been writing. And again, I think he got reassurance from de Lubac. They say that down in hell, every soul down in hell points to somebody else and says, he was responsible for my being here. That soul points in turn to somebody else. That soul points to somebody else. And at the end of every chain, there is always a priest.
Adam and Eve started out. Mm-hmm. He made it.
See, when Blondel would go to de Lubac, was de Lubac developing this on his own, or where was he?
De Lubac, and it was an interaction. See, de Lubac was considerably influenced by Blondel's philosophy. Blondel's philosophy gave de Lubac the intellectualization that he needed to get out of the prison of St. Thomas Aquinas. Okay. So de Lubac began moving along those lines. Then when Blondel had a few doubts, he turned to his friend de Lubac, who had obviously been in contact with him, and de Lubac said, don't worry. So the two began interacting. So Blondel had... Yes, a mutual support society, yes. We come to de Lubac. Father de Lubac, subject of the fourth of the articles, born around the turn of the century, who died only 2 years ago, that's 1991, was a passionate reader of Blondel and other dubious modern thinkers who were only, quote-unquote, half forbidden. These authors were not very permitted or not very allowed. Half forbidden by indulgent priests within the Jesuit order. Pius X, 15 years earlier, it's strictly forbidden, but they dismissed Pius X. He's just a peasant. As for Father de Lubac, next paragraph, and his comrades, they, on the contrary, found in Blondel the philosophical support for the faith which they were disappointed not to find in St. Thomas. See, Father de Lubac and the others, so many young priests at that time, they had the modern world in their blood. And the modern world in their blood, the liberalism in their blood, doesn't fit St. Thomas Aquinas. So they were looking for an out. Blondel was providing the out. St. Thomas, when they read St. Thomas, they simply felt it was like a prison. All of these dry, cold arguments. They didn't want their heads filled up with concrete. They wanted their heads filled up with bubble gum or with marshmallows, with warm, fuzzy feelings. They wanted to allow their heads to be filled with warm, fuzzy feelings. So cold steel of argument, forget it. De Lubac even admired certain authors because they were disapproved of by Rome. But from one of his teachers, he learned how to maintain an outward submissiveness. Like Blondel, de Lubac would disguise his doctrine. Such disguise being a hallmark of the new theologians, wrote Pius XII in the 1950s, which is why the Catholic world was so shocked to wake up a Vatican to a discovery of self-modernism. I can't remember, was it in Humani Generis? Yes, Yes, do you remember? Pope Pius XII said, they're muffled now, but watch out. They're muffled now, but watch out. Meaning, they're keeping the dampers on their doctrine now, but be careful, they're all ready to explode with these novelties. As Blondel had abandoned scholastic philosophy, that's the philosophy of St. Thomas, so de Lubac would abandon traditional theology. De Lubac told Blondel that he, Blondel, had made possible a new theology of the supernatural. This is, now this paragraph is de Lubac's teaching, the essence of de Lubac's teaching. Mother Church teaches that the whole supernatural order of grace is exactly that, a sheer gift of God, colored blue, way above anything colored brown, and totally different in its nature. A different order, infinitely superior, given by God as God wills, in a manner essentially independent of the receiving nature. On the contrary, the new theology of Blondel and de Lubac says that the supernatural is a need and a perfection of human nature. The big bleeding human heart is human nature, and this big bleeding heart needs a blue lining. My bleeding heart needs a lovely soft blue lining. I'll give you an example of what these characters could say. Blue, because that's the color of the Blessed Virgin Mary. These characters will misuse evil, they will harness even the Blessed Virgin Mary to their awful nonsense. They will misuse even the Blessed Virgin. So that's just an example. But in any case, the supernatural is a need of my nature. Therefore, the supernatural, without the supernatural, nature is frustrated in its essential aspirations. In other words, the supernatural is needed to complete nature. Nature is incomplete without the supernatural. In other words, the supernatural is not a sheerly gratuitous or freely given gift, but it's something that's demanded by me. It's not something that's freely given to me. It's something that's demanded by me, without which I'm incomplete. It's a part of nature owed to nature. In other words, the supernatural is not natural, but is not supernatural. The supernatural is natural. It lies within the bounds of nature. In other words, there's no such thing as blue. Everything supposedly blue is simply brown.
This is where they come from, these people that are into this healing religion. They demand that God should heal them.
Yes, yes.
It's their right there.
Yes, exactly. Human rights, same mentality. I have a right to God, I have a right to the sacraments. I'm divorced, I've remarried three times, but I have a right to the sacraments. I have a right to an annulment. It all belongs to me and I have a right to it. Yes, me, 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 me. Yeah? Here is the heart and soul of the new theology. Notice then, if supernature is part of nature, then grace is part of nature. If the state of grace is part of nature, then simply by being a man and having human nature, I automatically have the state of grace. And so long as I remain a man, I cannot lose the state of grace. Hey, hey, let's go down to the bar or somewhere else. No problems. All problems are gone. It's like a doctor walking into the hospital and declaring all illness is abolished. Well, that makes his work easy. That's another comparison of the archbishop. The priests declare sin is abolished. They can take a 7-day-a-week holiday at that point. Sin no longer exists. Hey, that makes life easy. So, here is the heart and soul of the new theology. Man, merely by being man, is saved because nature automatically contains grace. Hence, Karl Rahner is talking about anonymous Christians. In other words, people who were in the state of Jesus Christ's grace, whether they realize it or not, even whether they want it or not. People are Christians without realizing it, without even being baptized. From where, of course, it doesn't matter what religion you belong to. And we're fully into the era of indifferentism, obviously. Doesn't matter what religion you belong to, because as long as you're a human being, you have human nature. As long as you have human nature, you have sanctifying grace. As long as you have sanctifying grace, you're going to be saved. This is what John Paul II thinks. Again, in John Paul II, it's disguised under old-fashioned language, but as Professor Derman pulled out, that's what this Pope thinks. This Pope is absolutely convinced that everybody is saved. In other words, it doesn't matter what religion you belong to, hence, of course, ecumenism. And hence, no need of the Catholic Church for salvation. As one of you asked the other day, what happens to the missionaries? Well, the missionaries simply go all over the world telling everybody that they're good guys, because we Catholics know better than anybody else just what good guys we all are. Because we Catholics are now in possession of the doctrine that human nature automatically includes grace. That is what the Pope sincerely thinks. He avoids saying it quite bluntly, because that would still shock too many Catholics, just like Blondel and the others. And I think that the Pope seriously believes he's sincere. Are these modernists sincere? Ooh.
Ooh. Didn't he say it more sincerely when he gave that retreat from all the saints?
He pretty much said it, yes. He pretty much says it. And he's, you see, when he says it, he's convinced that he's proclaiming the good news. Now, the gospel is proclaiming the good news. When I tell everybody that they're saved, I'm proclaiming good news. Therefore, when I tell everybody that they're saved, I'm proclaiming the gospel. He's convinced that he's proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, because it's thanks to Jesus Christ that everybody is saved. And now you can see why the church is being destroyed. The concept of Catholicism that these people have in their minds is utterly different from the real Catholicism. Utterly different.
Well, the faithful in the church, this is something that they would be like a child who had misbehaved and they had a certain father. Obviously, the child is being corrected. But if Johnny comes up and the father changes his mind, obviously, and pats him on the head and says, now you're a good boy, you're okay, then Johnny no longer has any discernment. So now that what you have is a church who just loves having all the candy, and if you take the candy away, you're going to see anybody there?
Yep. That's about the size of it. Yep. The children don't are happy to no longer have a stern father. They're very happy to be given all the candy. And if you try taking away the candy, they scream blue murder. And that's the size of it. So, Blondel and de Lubac both knew, bottom of page 3, that their new theology defied the magisterium of the Catholic Church. But they told one another that theirs was, quote-unquote, the authentic Christianity. These guys have blinded themselves and they have got themselves convinced that their new version of Christianity is the true continuation and the full realization and the perfection of the old-fashioned Christianity. They have themselves convinced. A man can convince himself of an awful lot of things if he keeps trying. The more authentic tradition, the old doctrine revitalized. I mentioned this article too. In a famous article in 1946, the outstanding Thomist and Dominican, this is a good guy, put in the margin good guy, Gary Gulagrange, attacked the new theology as being a merely rehash of modernism. De Lubac responded with insults and mockery of Gary Gulagrange's, quote, simplistic views on the absoluteness of truth. This guy still believes that the mind can find out what's true. This guy still believes that the mind is made to submit to the object. This guy still believes that the object is king. This guy still believes that God is God. Goodness, what cave did he climb out of? De Lubac accused the Thomists of, quote, notorious ignorance of Catholic tradition. Imagine the nerve. He accuses the ones who are faithful to tradition of not knowing tradition. They're incredible, these characters. Incredible. But they get away with it. Well, they didn't get away with it so long as Pius XII was on top. But the cardinals didn't want another pope like Pius XII. And the cardinals picked a pope who would go along with these guys. A pope for these fellows. And John XXIII kept on approving of these fellows. I think I told you that Archbishop would have said that when the council began to roll, every time there was a head-on clash, as there was several, between the conservatives and the liberals, John XXIII clinched in favor of the liberals. Clinched the question in favor of the liberals. It's John XXIII's responsibility. It's the Pope's responsibility. Once again, the responsibility of the chiefs, the responsibility of the heads. Huge. When in 1951 Pius XII issued the same warning against the new theology in the encyclical that you had a look at, Humani Generis, de Lubac, who was mainly envisaged by by Pope Pius XII, I think I told you, that de Lubac was the one that he was aiming at. He didn't name him. De Lubac said, oh, it's highly one-sided. It doesn't concern me. Imagine. He knew perfectly well what it was about. It doesn't concern me. These characters are liars. They're blind. They're proud. They're blind. They're liars. And they are assassins of the church. They're terrible villains. They're heretics. And they deep down know what they're doing. After they've done it for a length of time, they're so blinded to themselves that they no longer know what they're doing. They blinded themselves to what they're doing. But deep down, they still know. Blondel died in 1949, but de Lubac lived until 1991. Interesting, top of page 4. There was enough Catholic sense left in de Lubac for even him who had fathered the council's theology to recognize that its aftermath was a disaster for the church. Towards the end of his days, like Maritain. Again, you see, the revolutionary that wants to level out and keep things going along without sinking further. And then when it sinks further in line with their own revolution, they stand back and say, oh, no, no, I didn't want that. The revolution eats its own children. And Vatican II ate up Maritain and ate up de Lubac. And when they later in their lives said, hey, this goes a bit too far, it's too late. It's their work. You've got to be careful when you let loose the dogs of revolution. They'll eat you up. Towards the end of his days, he undertook in a late work an examination of conscience. Quote, this period is as full of error as any. Maybe I should have concentrated more on essentials. For the last 7 or 8 years, I've been paralyzed by the fear of confronting head-on in concrete fashion the essential problems in their scalding reality. Out of wisdom or weakness, was I right or wrong? Would it not seem as though, despite myself, I have finished up in the camp of the integrists who horrify me? You see? He finds that he hated these guys, so he made a revolution. But when this starts happening, then he starts leveling out. So he says, good Lord, I'm like the integrists. Oh. Eh? The contradiction of these characters. They let loose the revolution, and then when the revolution gets going, then they say no. Nixon, you know, riding with the American system, with the revolutionary system, but when he tries to do something to hold it up, it just destroys him. The same media that pulled Nixon down glorify Clinton. They're revolution because they're revolutionary. Those media recognized instinctively in Nixon basically an enemy. Nixon might have opened up China. Nixon might have talked nicely to Russia. Nixon might have tried to play their game in one or two things. But deep down, he was still the man that condemned that pulled down Al Jazeera. And they hated him. And they knew he was basically an enemy. I'm not saying Nixon was a saint, please. I'm not saying at all Nixon was a saint. But it was to his credit that the media hated him. Anybody who's hated by these media has got something good about him.
They did glorify him when he died.
Well, that's sheer hypocrisy. Sheer hypocrisy. Once he's dead, we pretend, in order to deceive the conservatives, we pretend that we loved him. In order to make the conservatives think that we media are good guys. Sheer hypocrisy. Vile hypocrisy. Yes, but there was a particular hypocrisy in doing it with Nixon. Oh, it's rotten. These liberals are rotten. They're rotten to the core. There's nothing to be expected or hoped of from them. Nothing. So, thus de Lubac finished his life where he began it, in horror at the champions of integral or complete Catholic teaching, with only this difference. Whereas at the beginning of his career, he no doubt exulted in the prospect of demolishing them, at the end of his career, he realized, goodness gracious, at the end of his career, after bringing off the demolition, at least had the decency to drop a few tears over the demolished ruins now staring him in the face. When the faith was above him, he wanted to pull it down. But when it fell even below him, then he recognized what he'd done, began to recognize what he'd done. Our Lady of La Salette, oh boy, she has it, 1846. Demons unloosed from hell will put an end to faith little by little, even in those dedicated to God, the priests and theologians and cardinals and bishops. The demons will blind them in such a way that unless they're blessed with a special grace, these people will take on the spirit of the angels of hell. Several religious institutions, the Jesuits and the Dominicans, for instance, we'll lose all faith and we'll lose many souls. Evil books will be abundant on earth and the spirits of darkness will spread everywhere. A universal slackening in everything concerning the service of God. St. Paul put it more briefly, in the last days men will be traitors, stubborn, puffed up, and lovers of pleasures more than of God. This is the quotation I was wanting to know. Having an appearance of godliness, the appearance of Catholicism, but denying the power thereof. There's no guts to the candy floss church we've got now. It's just the appearances of the church, but behind the appearances, nothing but candy floss and fuzzy feelings.